This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. Got another great day. I want to let you know that the first half of this show is brought to you by At Home Care. They're located at 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, and that's right behind Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard. And you can reach them at 713-4639 by phone or www.athomecaretennessee.com. And the service that they offer is one of the best services that we have going in Rutherford County right now because, as I've said earlier, as you get older, you need more help. And most of us, we love the independence of being at home and around our normal surroundings. And they're offering a chance for you to be able to do that and with very little effort. And all you need to do is to call that number. And they offer errands, laundry, personal needs, light housekeeping, transportation to appointments, grocery shopping, meal preparation, medication reminders, and many, many other things. And they're 24/7. And we're just delighted that Melissa Warren has started that business. It's been here for about 4 years now, and there's a large number of people that are taking advantage of their services. So if you're one of those that you feel like that you need that, or maybe you're family members of someone, give them a call, and I'll guarantee you, you won't be sorry. Now, we have a very special guest on today, and we can talk about so many different things. First of all, and of course, Judge Royce Taylor, and everybody, I guess, in Rutherford County knows you, Judge. And that's the last time I'm going to call you Judge. From now on, it's Royce, because we've known each other for a long, long time. We go back before, even before we got into the business. And I guess I call this part of the business. But you did not originally grow up in Rutherford County.
Oh, yes, I did. I'm from here.
What did he just tell me, Brian?
I said my father was from Bedford County. All the Taylors are over there, but they started me here in Rutherford County. I'm still living on the same farm where I was born, so
wow.
I haven't gotten very far away from home.
And where you live is over there right next to the river. You got a beautiful place over there.
We live on the West Fork of the Stones River at Nice's Mill. My parents decided to move out in the country when my brothers were 8 and 10 years of age, and I was born the year they moved onto the farm. So I've been there my whole life except for 10 years when I was off in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And then we came back, but my Navy friends are amazed that I've only had one permanent address my whole life. So that's in the Navy, that was still my permanent address, Route 4 Murfreesboro.
That's even crazy for me, because I think I've lived in at least 14 different places in my life, and a lot of in my married life. But we grew up in a place that was just in a time that was almost perfect, because I graduated in 59 and you graduated about 3 years later, and we went to Central. And can you remember anything special during your Central times that you can recall that made a large difference in your life?
Well, of course, anybody that played football for Mr. Lee Pate,
yes,
talks about that as soon as they get together. It's just hard to that experience dominated your high school days if you played football with Mr. Lee Pate. He was such a major influence on all the people that played football for him.
And the thing about it is his discipline was so strong that it carried over decades later, because I have friends that became successful in business, maybe banking or in the legal profession. And any time they would see him coming, if they had a cigarette in their hand or maybe a drink that maybe had a little alcohol in it, it would disappear quickly. And I mean, can you think of anybody else that has that much influence other than maybe your dad or your mom?
No, Mr. Pate was a special person, and he was a World War II naval officer and had been on a ship that had been struck by kamikaze pilots, and so he had seen some the horrors of war and understood the need for discipline. And he was just a unique individual in the way he handled the football program there at Central, as well as the basketball program. I didn't play basketball, but he did both at that time.
And you kind of came from a military family in a way, you and your brother. And what made you decide to go into the particular field? And we're talking about the Navy. What aimed you at that direction?
Well, my brother Jimmy was 10 years older than me, and he had gone to the Navy and was in flight school down in Pensacola, what they call the NAVCAD program. If you've seen the movie An Officer and Gentleman, that was the type program you went through, where you went through training and became an officer and got your wings at the end of the program. So he had completed that program. And that sort of got me started looking at the Navy. And so when I was a senior in high school, I went to visit Senator Albert Gore at his office in Carthage and asked him for an appointment to the Naval Academy. And he gave me an appointment to the Naval Academy. And I went when I was 17, left Murfreesboro, got on a plane to Washington, D.C., and didn't know where I was going or how I was going to get there, but I got off the plane, found a bus to Annapolis, and showed up in time to get sworn into the Naval Academy. And so after 4 years there, then I had some interesting experiences. My wife and I lived in Japan. I was on board a ship in Japan in 66 and 67, and of course, I spent most of my time in Vietnam, and she stayed in Japan. Then, and without any contact of anyone back home, we weren't able to call home in those days because phones weren't available, for one thing. And the ones that were, if you went to a phone that could get an international call, it was $25 a minute. And I was making, my base pay was $222.30 a month. So there wasn't a lot of room to be spending $25 a minute for a phone call. So
I thought you guys made more than that. You know, I was just a grunt. And I think I was pulling in maybe 100 and something a month.
So ensigns didn't, that was our starting pay, because I remember those numbers very clearly. We got a raise, I think, the first year I was an ensign. It went up to $250 a month base pay. So
that's amazing.
Then we got another $47 for subsistence, and that paid our mess bill on board ship.
Now, when you went through the Naval Academy, what was that like? Because I've known a number of people that have done it, and to me it's so regimented, and you have so many other duties other than your academics. How did you manage to stay focused on that?
Well, it was a constant battle to try to be able to study and keep your grades up, as well as all your military things, especially the first year with, as you're called, plebes, and it's constant harassment, actually.
Yes.
It's the upperclassmen had control of your lives. And every morning you would get up before reveille and make sure all your uniforms were ready, and you were required to go to an upperclassman's room where they would ask you questions, and if you didn't know the answers to the questions they asked you, you would do push-ups or some other sort of physical exertion that got your day started off well. And then once we got to class, our professors were either military or civilian, and it was very professionally run as far as the classroom. You studied attention when you started class, and then you would be seats, and then it became a normal classroom routine. And then our class days were very professional. But then mealtimes were horror stories. You sat on the edge of your chair. You were not allowed to eat until the upperclassmen had all been served. Then you were asked questions during the meal that you had to answer, and you were sitting at a brace with your chin tucked down to your Adam's apple where you couldn't swallow even then if you could have eaten. So once the upperclassmen left, we got a chance to try to get a little food in, and I managed to gain 40 pounds and grow an inch and a half doing that the first 6 months I was at the Naval Academy, and my parents hardly recognized me when I came home because I'd grown so much. Of course, I had turned 18 and had a growth spurt right before I turned 18, and so I was one of the younger members of my class because my birthday was at the end of August, and I didn't turn 18 until after we'd already started classes.
Did you get into military strategy, naval battles and those type things, because they're preparing you to be an officer in the Navy?
We certainly did. That was part of our routine, was a lot of naval history. We had our own what we call yard patrol craft, which were miniature versions of a Navy ship. Mm-hmm. As far as operations go, they had they were small craft, but they had twin screws. They had the same bridge set up as a Navy, regular Navy ship, and we would go to class on those yard patrol boats. Have navigation. We'd have tactics. All sorts of things that went for. That was part of our training. Was going out to. Sea on the Chesapeake Bay in yard patrol crafts, and so we operated on those and had all kind of classes on those boats, and we had all kind of nautical. We didn't have a specific major when I was there. They mm-hmm. do now, but at that point you took a standard structured class. Everyone mm-hmm. took the same classes, everyone had the same exam in every class at the same time. So we would have exam days, and everyone would take that same exam on the same day. So it was very regimented as far as our class structure went. We also was heavy on all the math classes, mm-hmm. All kind of the science classes, and toward being able to operate a 1,200-pound steam plant in the engineering section of our classes, because that was the standard Navy shipboard setup. So that was what we were aimed at, to be naval engineers.
Did you get to critique battles and all the different options that the captain or the admiral would have and all that, because that's I think of all the major battles that I have tried to keep up with, the Navy battles are to me are the most interesting, because they pretty much take in everything. I mean, you have the guys that are on the ships, you have the aircraft carriers that have the ace pilots that are flying them, but you also have the other different divisions, and one that you went into, of course, was the Navy SEALs, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, because I never will forget, and we were talking about this earlier, when I went through jump school at Benning in the early 60s, one of the guys that probably had everything more together than anybody else was one of the Navy SEALs, and I was just amazed at his abilities.
Well, we did study some of that, but more of that was toward senior officers in the Naval War College. So mm-hmm. We were looking at the basics at the Naval Academy, and of course, anytime you're in any sort of profession, your training never stops. It's mm-hmm. the same way now. You're constantly reading and constantly learning. So that never stopped in the Navy as well. And of course, in the SEAL team, every time we weren't deployed somewhere, we were sending people to every kind of school that you can think of. Mm-hmm. So because you needed specialists in language, you needed specialists in medicine, you needed specialists in every kind of field you can think of. And so all of our people were cross-trained and trained in various specialties. Probably the SEALs have some of the best trained people and some of the most varied training of any of the services, because they cover so many different disciplines.
Well, I know that. All right, you came from Murfreesboro, and you go into the Navy, and I know you have a number of options once you leave the academy. Why in the world would you choose something like the Navy SEALs? What was it that attracted you the most to that?
Well, I'd grown up swimming in Stones River, learning to swim on my own.
Whoa, big difference.
So I guess I'd always loved the water. My dad was a big fisherman. I stayed in a boat with him fishing a lot. And the Navy interests me in water, and I just really was interested. I didn't start out in the SEAL team. At that time, we had underwater demolition teams that came out of World War II. Let me give you a little background. People talk about it with so much about the SEALs in the news today, but people may be interested in some of the history. During World War II, after Guadalcanal in the Pacific, the Navy started island hopping and making amphibious landings with the Marines to take the Japanese-held islands. There was a tremendous failure in a landing at a island called Tarawa.
Yeah, remember.
And
that.
The landing craft went in, they dropped their ramps, and they had hit a coral reef, and they were several hundred yards offshore, and the Marines went off the ramps into water over their head. And so there were more casualties from the drowning than there were from the Japanese. So quickly determined that we need to scout the beaches and that sort of thing, and underwater demolition was born to both scout the beaches prior to the landing, and then if there were such things as coral reefs or obstacles, and you see the typical obstacles that were on Normandy, then that was our job to go in there prior to the landing craft getting there and try to blow holes in the reef or blow up obstacles to allow the landing craft to get the Marines to shore. It was our job to get the Marines safely to shore.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was what we started with. And so the underwater demolition after World War II continued to go with the Marines. The Marines stayed on board ships in the Mediterranean and in the Caribbean. We kept a Marine ready force on board ships. They went into Lebanon during the 60s. They went into the Dominican Republic. There were forays into Central America. The Marines are very active, and of course they are part of the naval forces.
Mm-hmm.
And it was our job to
they don't think so, though.
They won't tell you that, but they do fall under the Department of the Navy. I rode the ship with the Marines. I was on board a landing ship dock as an underwater demolition officer, and we had a company of Marines on board. We were with a whole squadron of amphibious ships with other Marines on the other ships. So, and we were in the Caribbean, that was our job, was to make sure the Marines could land safely. Of course, then there were issues with once they landed, whether they were safe or not, but certainly it was our job to try to get them to shore. So that was the precursor of the SEAL team. In 1962, President Kennedy ordered that each service would have a special warfare section. And so the Navy looked around and saw underwater demolition. The Navy wasn't interested in special warfare. They had submarines, nuclear submarines, they had aircraft carriers. They had destroyers and cruisers, and they really sort of saw us as a something they had to do, but they weren't interested in funding us. But the SEALs became in being in 1962, and there were two teams. There was SEAL Team 1 on the west coast at Coronado, and SEAL Team 2 at Little Creek in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we still had the underwater demolition teams, which drew people out of each of the underwater demolition teams to create the SEALs. The SEAL teams were very small when I was there. We only had a couple hundred people in each team.
Hmm.
We had very little money to supplies, even during wartime. We were sort of a backdoor child. Then during Vietnam, when the SEALs started operating as counterinsurgent forces in the riverine environment in the Delta and having some very good successes in interrupting Viet Cong sappers and swimmers, and all of a sudden we got a lot of attention within the Navy. Very few people knew about us outside the Navy, but we started getting more support and supplies, and so we were able to operate a lot better, and that sort of started the special warfare program going for the Navy. Were those early successes in Vietnam. They had some of the most successful operations, and most people don't know about them because they were all classified at the time.
That's one of the things that makes it so intriguing, because a lot of people have no idea about what the Navy SEALs were about and are about, and they're just now starting to find out some of it because some of the operations that have been held recently. But you guys were almost like the special forces, but add water onto it. I mean, it's a lot of similar training.
Well, the SEAL stands for Sea, Air, Land. That was our acronym, is how the SEAL came about, to be able to go anywhere, anytime, and any entry type thing they could come up with. So we and a lot of the things we did were very experimental. And in fact, today with the money that's being thrown at the special warfare, there are a lot more newer things that are coming along. I was just very happy to have a rifle that wouldn't jam and a radio that would work. That was the two things that I thought were the most important.
Did you have an M16?
Uniquely, the SEALs carried a weapon that was not available to anyone else in Vietnam. We had what were called Stoner light machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
We bought those, what we called open purchase. They were not in the supply system, either the Army or the Navy. They fired belted ammo, which used the same ammo as the M16, the 5.56 ammo, but you could fire those at 1,000 rounds per minute. Before I went to Vietnam, I took one to the firing range, because normally automatic weapons are fired in 2 and 3 round bursts.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see how reliable the Stoner was, because there was some questions about reliability. So I had my gunner's mate hook up 2 cases of ammo, which had 10,000 rounds of belted ammo. And I said, don't let up on the trigger till you've fired all 10,000 rounds. Let's see how reliable this Stoner is. And for 10 minutes, he stood there and fired 10,000 rounds of ammo at 1,000 rounds a minute. And
how did it hold up to that climate over there?
The climate was not a problem. We've never had, in our operations, the ones we had were outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, of course, when we took the weapon back to the armory and I turned it in, the gunner's mate in charge of the armory had some fairly salty Navy language that he used on me, because I had burned up the barrel in the Stoner. It had no rifling left in the barrel. And so I told him, I said, Gunner, let's put a new barrel in it then. And so we took that gun with us to Vietnam and never had a problem with it. It was a very, very reliable gun, and one of the best guns that we had. Now, we carried all different kinds of weapons. Mm-hmm. So we had M16s, we had Stoners, we had M60 machine guns. We had people that carried shotguns with duck bills on them that had created a sort of a rectangular pattern to clear jungle trails. We had people that carried AK-47s. So we had sniper rifles. We had our own weapons that we packed up and crated and shipped with us when we traveled to Vietnam. We flew on old World War II four-engine C-118s that took forever to get there, but we had our gear with us, and we never let our gear out of our sight.
Did you ever parachute into an area? Because I know that that's part of your training. Or did you mostly work from landing?
We worked from helicopters in Vietnam. Okay. That was when we started developing the helicopter warfare. We were doing the same thing that the SEAL Team 6 guys did going into Pakistan. We started using those type hit-and-run ops with helicopters. And that was been developed over the years as well. So now the equipment is much better, but the techniques were the same things we started using in the Vietnam era. Of course, you know, 40 years, there are lots of techniques.
Is he holding up a sign for us?
He says take a break.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Judge Royce Taylor.
This is Truman Jones. Let me take just a minute to tell you about my friends down the road in Shevelville at Pirtle and Howerton Automotive. Whether you're looking for a new or used vehicle, Pirtle and Howerton is the place to go. Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC. You can find anything you need at Pirtle and Howerton Automotive in Shevelville. They take pride in the vehicles they sell and strive to succeed in great customer experience and satisfaction. Whether you are looking for a new or used, their friendly and knowledgeable staff are eager to assist you in your car buying process. You can check out their extensive inventory at PearlHowerton.com.
That's Pirtle and Howerton Automotive, 2006 North Main in Shelbyville. Don't let a 20-minute drive cost you thousands of dollars. Go by, see them today, or give them a call, 1-800-264-6800. Or online at PirtleHowerton.com.
Hello, this is Jim Bryan at First Bank.
And I'm Chuck Lewis. First Bank presents Good Neighbor Events, news of what our local schools, churches, and community groups are doing.
Well, here it is Friday and time for Good Neighbor Events from WGNS. That big feeding fellowship tonight from 5:30 until 8 at the Walnut Grove Missionary Baptist Church. They reach out and welcome everyone with a dinner on Friday evenings. For information, call their pastor, R.W. Seibert, at 896-1553. The church is at 2480 Twin Oak Drive. And if you love a play, Romeo and Juliet, tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Center for the Arts in Uptown Murfreesboro. In addition, there's a Sunday matinee at 2. Call them at 904-ARTS for information. And over in neighboring Cannon County, the hilarious musical Hairspray, tonight and tomorrow night, 7:30, and a Sunday matinee at 2. And if you come early at the Arts Center of Cannon County, you can enjoy dinner at their restaurant. Oh yes, Movies Under the Stars at 8:30 tonight over at Mitchell Nielsen Primary School. That's 8:30 tonight. Tomorrow night, it's over at the Hobgood Elementary School, and this is a free service of the Murfreesboro Parks and Recreation Department. This week's flick is the animated Yogi Bear. Hey, there's a cruise in tonight starting at 5 o'clock, sponsored by the Murfreesboro Hot Rod Club, and this is over at the Avenue of Murfreesboro in the parking lot right behind Belk. And on hot days, be sure to check on your senior citizen loved ones or anyone who's alone and ill. Fans and air conditioners definitely do save lives. If you need one, contact Dwight Ogleton at the Cool Aid Program. That number is 818-2459. That's 818-2459. And for a Friday, those are WGNS Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by First Bank.
Weather Eye.
Partly to mostly cloudy this afternoon with showers and isolated thunderstorms, some strong, reach a high in the low 90s. Isolated showers and storms possible early tonight, a low near 72. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now it's 88.
You wouldn't let a plumber fix your roof,
so let a mechanic change your oil.
This is Amy at Todd's Complete Auto Care.
WGNS listeners get a standard oil change and full service for only $24.95.
Oil changing?
$24.95.
Todd's Complete Auto Care on Southeast Broad across from Discovery Center.
Hello, this is Frieda Morgan with First National Bank of Murfreesboro. I'd like for you to come over and visit with our bank. Our branch is relatively new to Rutherford County, but our bank was chartered back in 1900. We are a safe, sound, and stable bank. come and see why there's a difference at First National Bank of Murfreesboro. 2230 Mercury Boulevard, near the intersection of South Rutherford Boulevard. First National Bank of Murfreesboro. Member FDIC.
He knows Rutherford County's past, and his wisdom can give good insight into our future. It's The Truman Show. Here again, Truman Jones.
And today's guest, Judge Royce Taylor.
Sausage and biscuits, gravy and grits, home ground, homemade, it'll get you fits. Blueberry pancakes and corn cakes too, I'm a-licking my lips now, how about you?
I think Brian said that that was Judge Royce Taylor singing that song, but it really wasn't.
It kind of sounds like him.
It does a little bit. But,
or Blankenship.
But this guy was an attorney too, John Blankenship. Yeah, yeah.
Don't all attorneys sing like that?
They sing pretty well, most of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really do. They can really handle a tune. And that was John Blankenship and Friends. And Avant Lane, Ken Frizzell, Sarah Frizzell, and Billy Yearwood are part of the band that's there every Saturday from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Readable Mill, and that's 5418 Murfreesboro Road in Readable, Tennessee, and you can reach them at 563-6455. And actually, there, if you take the John Bragg Highway out about 8 or 10 miles, get about as far as Cripple Creek Road, turn left on the old Woodbury Highway, and it's about 2 miles to the where the river crosses, and you'll see the mill on the left, and it's a wonderful place to go. It's one of the few operating mills still in this country, and it's fully operational, and you can actually dine from the food that is prepared there. So if you have a time that you want to get away and just really enjoy yourself, on a Saturday morning, take off, because you'll see most of us there. And if you ever go once, you'll continue to go there. And Judge, I saw you there.
I was there 2 weeks ago with my wife and her brother. We had a great time there, and the food is absolutely outstanding.
It really is. Did you have the blueberry pancakes?
I did. Whole wheat.
Now, you were eating a whole lot better there in Readable than you were in Vietnam, I guarantee you. And one of the things that, I mean, it's the clandestine, the all the training, all the abilities that you guys had that makes it so interesting. Everybody's seen the movies with Sylvester Stallone over there and things like that. And you guys were very similar to that. I mean, you didn't have the uniforms. You were over there as they probably couldn't tell you from civilians when you were there.
Well, we wore nondescript uniforms. We didn't have any, I never wore any ranking device, no name tags, unless we were operation, wore camouflage uniforms. Sometimes we wore civilian clothes. Some of my men wore blue jeans, even on operations. They didn't like the camouflage pants, and they would wear Levi's too. So we operated pretty well on our own. It was interesting because we didn't follow the normal chain of command, which is how you have to operate with clandestine activities. We collected our own intelligence. We got permission to go in certain areas, and we had to be very careful to make sure that whoever we got permission from didn't compromise our operation. Mm-hmm. And then we operated on the intelligence we gathered, and we were assigned there would be one SEAL team unit in each province. And I say unit, that we operated in very small units. I had an assistant with me. I was officer in charge, and I had an assistant, and I had 12 enlisted men. And he would take one squad and go one way, and I'd take one squad and go the other way. And so I had 6 men with me, as well as an interpreter and a former Viet Cong who served as our scout. You would be out in the middle of nowhere with very little contact and hoping that you'd be able to raise a Navy gunship on your radio if you got into trouble. So that was why I said our radio was our best means of communication, and we had no backup communications.
How were you able to keep up with the coordinates of being in that strange area? Because if you called in fire, you better make sure you get it right.
Well, we didn't have coordinates. We had to use smoke because we were out in the jungle areas and in rice paddy areas. And so if we needed a gunship, we'd have to give them a smoke grenade to mark our position or mark where we wanted the fire to go. And we had to be in contact with them on the radio. Otherwise, they had no clue where we were. They couldn't find us because we would be well hidden wherever we were. But of course, once you get into that position, we tried not to operate to where we, if we got into a firefight, we had failed in our mission because our mission was to gather intelligence generally, and we did not want to reveal our position or let anybody know we were there. So there were a few times that we got into situations where we had to have the gunships give us a little help, but normally we weren't looking to give away our position, and if we were doing a lot of shooting, it certainly wasn't because we wanted to. It was because we had to. But that was always an issue, was making sure that we had contact with our Navy gunships, and those guys would go out on a limb for us. They would really put themselves out there in the middle of anything that came along to try to protect us.
You guys were counting on each other. You're counting on one of the persons was with the Viet Cong who had came over to our side, and you were just putting your hands out there, putting your full faith in them that they were going to take care of you and you were going to take care of them.
Yes. And a lot of our information was derived from informants who we paid, and sometimes they were good informants and sometimes they weren't. The CIA furnished us with funds. I would go to Saigon and collect a suitcase of money and bring back to pay informants and buy information, basically, and we would report what we found out up the line. It was used in other areas. So a lot of the information we gathered was useful not only to us, but to other intelligence agencies. So there were a lot of people, different people looking at us to gather information and pass it along. Some of the things we gathered were sort of strategic as to what long-term plans were. We uncovered some ammunition caches that were being put in, and we found some informants that said they were waiting for us to leave. So they were stocking, they were stockpiling, and we found a sampan full of ammo on one occasion. I went out into what was called the Plain of Jars, right on the Cambodian border, and we found a sampan loaded down. The gunships had run off the folks, and they took us back out there to destroy it. And they weren't real happy about us destroying all their stuff, but that was what they were doing. They were bringing things down through Cambodia to stockpile for us leaving. That was in 1971. They knew we were leaving. They just were waiting on us to leave. So they were stockpiling supplies and caching them in various places along the rivers and different places. And so we uncovered things like that along the way. But that was some of the information we were trying to uncover as to what their plans were, what their long-term plans were.
And you were mostly a night outfit. You travel mostly by night.
We operated at night, and we'd wait till it was full dark before we ever made our way out and insert in places where it was hard to be seen, either by helicopter or boat. One time I went by truck. but anyway, we'd get there. But generally, we were operating in a riverine environment, and most of the times we could get places by boat. Sometimes we needed a helicopter. And the Army helicopter guys wouldn't deliver us at night. We had to get Navy choppers to deliver us at night. Their guys weren't night qualified like our Navy pilots were.
You're hitting my outfit now. My goodness.
Well, some of the Army pilots were warrant officers who looked like they were about 18 years old. I'm not sure how they old, but they looked 18, and they didn't have a lot of experience and didn't have any night experience. So the Navy pilots were the ones that would deliver us at night. And so arranging all the logistics was always a big issue. That was my job, to make sure everything was organized and planned in advance. And so it took a lot of planning for, you know, just a small operation, because you had to go through so many different areas.
You know, the sad thing about that war, of course, there's a lot of sad things about the war, but a lot of it was fought on the television sets in the United States. And a lot of information that was coming back was terrible information, tainted information. And you were talking about earlier about the Tet Offensive, where we supposedly got rammed during the Tet Offensive, and that was not the truth.
Well, no, the Tet Offensive was a total failure for the Viet Cong. They were almost wiped out. Mm-hmm. Of course, everything was on TV showing them overrunning South Vietnam, but they overran it, but they mostly got destroyed in the process as a fighting organization. And I was there in 1971. I would get in my Jeep and get on the road and drive from our location up to Saigon. Always had a gun with me, but the roads were relatively safe. I'd stop along the road, and you could stop at a place and buy barbecue at a little stand. And it was one of those things that people didn't realize. South Vietnam was a beautiful country. If you ate locally, you ate pretty well. The chow in the mess hall wasn't too good, but you could go buy fresh seafood just about anywhere. Along the road, there were lots of fishermen and people operating out of the Mekong Delta that had fresh food, fresh vegetables, fresh rice, fresh fish, fresh shrimp. So it's actually a beautiful country. I'd love to go back someday.
Do you think you will ever go back? You know, Greg Tucker's wife is from there, and they went back recently. And they say it's just absolutely beautiful, but there have been changes made. And the Vietnam people are some of the sweetest, nicest people you'll ever run into. But you know, fighting over there, it gives you a different perspective of what happened. And then your perspective of the things that went on are an entirely different version, of course, than what they feed us over here. And I never have understood how a war can become as political as that one did. I mean, it's amazing to me.
Well, of course, if you look at what was going on, we were in a Cold War, and the Cold War continued with Russia, and this was sort of a proxy war as part of the Cold War. And from the standpoint of the Cold War, used a lot of Russian assets as well as a lot of our assets. You know, of course, then there was the Chinese influence that was there as well. And we were worried about the Chinese getting involved like they had in Korea, which is still an unresolved issue. So there were, you know, there were lots of political things that were involved for people that sort of looked at the big picture between the Cold War with the USSR, and then with the Chinese being involved in the whole strategy for the Asian area. And that was way above my head at the time. It's nice to look back on some of it and reflect a little bit now, but at the time I was just trying to get through the next day. That was we had a saying in the SEAL team, the only easy day was yesterday.
And then you decided to take up on another war. You came back. You went through law school, you became an attorney, and now you're at the highest level that you can go to in a county. You're a circuit judge. How do you feel every day going to the courthouse, or the judicial building, I guess it is now? And that, it, to me, is one of the toughest jobs that there is in the community, because you're deciding a lot of things that have to do with people's lives.
Well, I enjoy my job very much. I like to go to work. I like what I do. What bothers me are the cases that involve so many children whose lives are disrupted by divorce. I hear a lot of divorces. We have some 1,400 divorces a year filed here in Rutherford County. And usually the numbers run about half of those involve minor children. And I just told a couple this morning were getting divorced, and they had a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I told them, I said, you've got a long way to go. I said, you're going to be parents the rest of your lives, so you're going to have a relationship even though you're divorced. You've got to be civil to each other for the benefit mm-hmm. of these children. I said, these children are not part of this divorce, but they're the ones that are affected most by it because they're going to be shuttled back between parents on a weekly basis or where they go back and forth. They listen to parents fussing about paying child support. They listen to parents fussing about so-and-so not doing this or doing that. And it's pretty traumatic on children to go through that process of divorced parents. It's traumatic enough for the parties to go through it, but the children are really affected, especially teenagers. Mm-hmm. The teenagers really are having a tough time in their lives anyway. Being a teenager is tough enough, and then on top of that, their parents are getting a divorce. I've had children that have had very dark letters that they've written, suicide threats. It's always a problem with the children being affected by the divorce. So that's what really bothers you in those type of situations. It's very difficult to deal with those, and to hope you do the right thing for the children and work out a plan that minimizes the disruption on them. The majority of the attorneys do a very good job of working those things out with the folks before they come to court. We don't try that many divorces, or we don't try 1,400 a year. We only try a few of those numbers because most of them get resolved in mediation before they get to court. And that's the best way to get it done because the parties know what they can live with and what they can't live with, and are much better than I do. They know what will work and won't work. Because when I see them, I only see them for a few hours while mm-hmm. they're testifying. I may hear from the children if the children are older. I may hear from school teachers. But I don't get a full picture sometimes of mm-hmm. what's going on, and I realize that. So that makes you a little wary about what sort of ruling you can make when you are not sure exactly what's really going on here. And sometimes, they come back because whatever I ruled didn't work and they have to redo it. And sometimes they come back because what they agreed to in mediation didn't work and they come back. So some of these cases have stuck with me for years because I recently had one that I think I started in 1998 and the youngest goodness. Child just turned 18. And I think they'd been back in court just about every year. So it was really tough on the children to go through that process.
It makes you wonder how people can get to the stage of where the children become almost just a second thought, because your first responsibility should be to your child. And when you take that child and then all of a sudden it's security and it's taken away from him and his whole life is changed. That's tough on an individual like that. But then I've seen it so many times when they go to court, it ends up into a fight between the mom and the dad, and almost like the kids should be taking sides one way or the other. It's extreme. I don't see how you can sit there and listen to that.
Well, I'll tell you what's disturbing. I had a case where the parties had been married 40 plus years and they were getting a divorce. And for some reason, one of the adult daughters was called as a witness. And she was in her 30s. And she got on the stand and testified, I hate both my parents. What they've done is fought all through our childhood and after we're grown. That's very powerful when you have somebody that comes in there and said, I hate both my parents. But that's what happens to children whose parents fuss and fight and don't take the children's needs into account. The children end up rejecting their parents as they get older. And so that's a scary thought for people to be thinking about what might be going on through a child's mind and ending up. That was one of the most powerful pieces of testimony I recall, because it just struck me. This girl has spent 35 years listening to her parents fight, and now she's coming into court and publicly stating in front of them, I hate both of them.
Yeah, you wonder how in the world did they stay together for 40 years when both of them are so self-centered and only interested in what their own interests are.
Well, they couldn't explain that. I'm not sure how they did it.
No. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Judge Taylor.
It's Friday. Hi, this is Tom at Kirk and Burt's. Stop by and pick up a rack of ribs for just $15. Kirk and Burt's, 517 Cason Lane, just down from the theater. Call us at 893-FOOD, and we also deliver in the Cason Lane area.
Did you know a vehicle you buy from Stan McNabb Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, GMC, and Stan McNabb Jeep, Dodge, Chrysler in Tullahoma, and even Stan McNabb Ford in Lewisburg, and a vehicle you buy from another dealership, they may look alike, but the truth is, they're very different. Only the new or pre-owned vehicle from Stan McNabb has oil changes and tires for life at no additional charge. Check it out at stanmcnabb.com. See dealer for complete details.
What a day.
Is it true about you and Charlene?
Who's Charlene?
Oh, no. You have amnesia again.
Seriously, what's with the music?
I'm playing new instant games. I like to add extra drama before I scratch.
Well, then,
I am your husband's secret twin brother.
Instant games from the Tennessee Lottery. Play them in your own way. And now play the newest games. Hot, hot cash, hundreds of dollars, triple winning sevens, and stacks of cash. The Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing fun.
Huh. It says here the Tennessee Lottery has raised $2 billion for education in just over 7 years. It would take forever to count that high.
Actually, Dad, if you counted a number every second, it would take 63 years.
How'd you get so smart?
I'm a Hope Scholar.
Students across the state are benefiting from Tennessee Lottery-funded programs. Let us know how these dollars have impacted your life. Share your story of hope at seehowitaddsup.com. The Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing fun.
You are listening to The Truman Show on WGNS, AM and FM. Now, back to Truman Jones.
And today's guest, Judge Royce Taylor.
Well, I'm glad you did that for me, Brian. Judge, I have...
You said you weren't calling me that. Unless you're in court, you don't have to call me Judge.
Royce, this has been a real pleasure. I have a lot of respect for you in a number of ways. Your service to the country is beyond what most people would even offer. And then your service to the community here has been impeccable. And I want to let you know how lucky we are in Rutherford County to have an individual like you that is sitting in such a responsible position here in Rutherford County. You always handle your work above board. You're always committed to doing the right thing. And is there anything at all that you would like to tell the people in Rutherford County about any of the things that are near and dear to you or any type of information that you might want to give to them?
Well, thank you, Truman, for those kind words. But I just think Rutherford County is my home,
yes.
And it's always going to be my home. I plan on staying here until Woodfins comes to get me, I think, is our plan.
And we'll still be here.
Yeah, we'll still be here. It's a great place, and I hope that everyone here recognizes what a great community we have here. We do have a good community here. And while there are differences among folks, we all pull together when we need to.
Rutherford County is one big family, and I think that's one of the attractions that we have here, and they see that. And I have said this before, and there's nothing more true than the fact that Rutherford County has the best judicial system of any place in the state of Tennessee, and any place that I have ever gone. We've got the best judges and the best district attorney's office, and I would compare them to anybody. And every one of you guys I have the utmost respect for, and I want to see you guys continue on as long as you can stay there.
Well, thank you very much. We just try to do our job.
And you do it well. And we will be back with you, I guess, Monday. And our guest will be Buddy Royston.